Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
Welcome to the Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy podcast. I'm Declan, the son.
And I'm Jane, the mom. This is the podcast where we talk about brutal crimes, bizarre occurrences, and get you drunk with cocktails themed around one of our stories. To lighten things up, we'd like to end our time with a chaser. Please keep in mind some of our stories might be upsetting to young or sensitive ears.
We love hearing from our listeners, so feel free to contact us by email or social media. You can find our contact info in the show notes for this episode. If you'd like to support us through Patreon, you can find us there at Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast, or use the link in our show notes.
Hey there, fellow true crime aficionados. We're the host of Bad Acts, a true crime podcast. I'm Danielle.
And I'm Aaron.
Join us every Thursday for twisted true crime tales of dark deeds and despicable people. We focus on lesser known unique stories with a new case each week. We've covered family annihilators, cannibals, revenge killings, killer kids, mysterious murders, survivor stories, and much more. We've even tackled stories of people who blamed zombies, vampires, ghosts, and voodoo for their bad acts.
Of course, we know they're the only ones to blame. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts, or you can visit our website at badactspod.com.
If you like fresh stories and new perspectives on crime, Bad Acts will be your new jam. Join Bad Acts every Thursday. Stay safe, y'all.
See you soon.
During a dark and desolate winter over, British behavioral scientist Drew Fairfield has been found murdered. Your job is to solve the crime. To do this, you need to immerse yourself in the victim's diaries, interviews, and secret recordings alongside DCI Tessa McAllister as she leads the investigation to uncover the truth about Drew's death. There are only 16 people left on the base, and the murderer must be one of them. Establish motive, opportunity, and alibi for each of the suspects and figure out who killed Drew. Head to coldtapes.com where you can sign up and charge your suspect. Correctly identify the murderer and you'll be entered into a draw to win the prestigious title of Super Sleuth of the Year at CrimeCon London and a £10,000 reward. Over 18s and residents of Great Britain only. T's and C's apply.
Welcome back, everybody. Nice to have you come hang out with us while we tell some good and terrible stories.
Yes, mine is interesting. It's similar to a previous bizarre I did.
Okay, cool.
What are you going to be telling us about today?
I have a serial killer that we haven't covered before. I'm doing BTK.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I wonder if they're going to ever come out with the that version of the Dahmer show. Because at the end of Dahmer, they showed him just briefly, I believe.
Oh.
Like, insinuating that there's going to be a second season based on him.
Oh. I haven't seen that show, so... That's interesting.
Oh, you haven't seen Dahmer?
No, I haven't.
It's pretty good.
Pretty messed up, too, I bet.
Yeah.
Yeah. All that stuff is. But, you know, it's gory, and we love it, and we can't live without it.
Yes.
So, to go with the BTK drink, to go with the BTK story, I brought the drink Red Raider because BTK's okay. name is Dennis Raider. So the drink is made of 1 ounce of Cointreau, 3/4 ounce of lemon juice, 2 ounces of bourbon, 1/3 ounce of grenadine, and then garnished with a lemon twist. The steps are pretty basic. In a shaker with ice, add all the ingredients and shake well. Then strain into a chilled rocks glass with ice and garnish with your lemon twist. So.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah, let's give it a try.
Here we go. Oh.
That's kind of like.
Sour.
Really?
See, mine is really tart. I like it because it's bourbon. Yeah. I thought, well, first of all, the name of the drink is Red Raider and mine is pink. And I used the appropriate amount of grenadine, but it's not red at all.
It's kind of cool looking though.
Yeah. It's, you know, could be sweeter for my taste, but it's a good drink. I will drink it. It is not one that I am going to dump down the drain. I will finish it. It's a finish drink.
Yeah, that's not bad.
We have to come up with our rating system on how good or bad they are. We just...
yeah.
Like, it's a bottom of the glass drink, meaning I will absolutely drink it to the bottom of the glass. Or it's a sipping drink, and I will take one sip and then throw it away. Or
drainer, just dump it down the drain.
Yeah, there we go. It's a drain drink. I like that. Okay, so let's talk about Dennis Rader, otherwise known as BTK. So he was born on March 9th, 1945, in Pittsburgh, Kansas. He was the oldest son, later getting three other brothers. As an adult, he reported that his parents were fairly absent, often working long hours, and he felt ignored by his mother. Which, okay, don't ignore your kids, but don't use that as an excuse to be a serial killer either. Rader grew up in Wichita, Kansas, and attended Wichita Heights High School. As a child, he had some obsessions, and as we obviously find out through all these serial killers, that most of them often do have weird obsessions. He had some sexual fantasies that were geared towards sadism and torturing women, especially if they were trapped or helpless. So,
Jesus.
He really liked
it. Okay.
Yeah. He wanted to be in control. Rader also acted out his fantasies by cross-dressing, torturing and killing animals, voyeurism, and autoerotic asphyxiation.
Hmm. Not a nice guy.
We'll just leave that there. He attended college for 1 year, but dropped out after getting just average grades. He joined the U.S. Air Force and served for 4 years from 1966 to 1970, being stationed in several other countries. After leaving the Air Force, he moved to a suburb of Wichita and worked at a supermarket. He got married to Paula Dietz in May 1971. The couple were eventually, they would eventually have a daughter, Carrie, and a son, Brian. In 1973, he earned an associate's degree in electrical engineering from an area community college. He later attended Wichita State University, where he earned a bachelor's degree in administration of justice in 1979. From 1974, you know, I don't know. I tried to kind of look it up. I was wondering if it was like a criminal justice degree or something. Maybe it was. I don't.
Administration
I don't know.
Of justice. That's,
yes. Which,
like, is he administering justice or?
Yeah, I don't
is
know.
He the administrator.
I don't know. It's super weird.
Weird title.
100%. And he didn't really use it. As, like, I mean, he probably was able to get higher paying jobs because he had a bachelor's degree and, you know, but it's not like he went into law enforcement, really. We'll get into, like, okay. What, I mean, he did some law enforcement adjacent jobs for a little while, but exactly my next point. From 1974 to 1988, he worked for ADT Security Systems as an installer and would go to homes installing security alarms.
Wow.
Which
probably knew all the codes and stuff.
Exactly. And he knew like what homes would have them and which ones didn't. So, you know, and if he were going to get around the alarm, if they had an alarm, he probably knew how to do that. Although I didn't see in any of my research that talked about, like, he cut some phone lines and stuff to get into houses, but it didn't say anything about him disabling alarms. Although I think, you know, at the time people knew that he was out, or knew that somebody was out killing, you know, people, and they were putting alarms in. So it did say that he installed some alarms in people who were probably trying to protect themselves from him, of course.
That's fucked up.
Right. For 2 years, he worked as an area supervisor for the U.S. Census Bureau. After leaving the census game in 1991, he began working for Park City as a compliance officer and dog catcher. He seemed to appreciate his power in this position, and neighbors said that he was overzealous and strict about policies, and he was described as being a bully. So, not really a nice guy, and he would often harass single women. So, he thought he, you know, was this really cool guy because he was a dog catcher. I'm sorry, you're not a cool guy because you're a dog catcher. But whatever. Besides his employment work stuff, he was also active in his community. He was a member at his local Lutheran church and once was elected to the president position of the church council. He also was a leader in the Cub Scouts. From all outward appearances, Rader may have come off like a jerk to some people, but he was also helpful to others. It seemed that no one knew he was hiding some really big, dark, gross, terrible secrets that made him, in many people's opinions, an absolute monster. So let's talk about what made him a monster. The known crime started in January 1974 with several members of the Otero family. The victims were Joseph Otero Sr., the father, Julie Otero, the mother, Joseph Otero Jr., who went by the name Joey, he was 9 years old, and Josephine Otero, who went by Josie, and she was 11 years old. The bodies of the family were found by their older children when they came home from school. Prior to entering the Otero home, Rader cut the phone lines, then gained access to the house through a back door when the dog was let out to go to the yard, go potty. So he broke in that way. I'm going to cover the stuff I'm going to gloss over it because I don't want to go into all the gross details. So he used bags for suffocation and ropes that he brought with him to strangle and hang the family members. Rader's DNA was found near the body of the daughter, Josie, but it didn't identify him until later. So, I mean, this is back in 74. So, you know, they're blood typing at that point. They're not DNA profiling at that day and age. So, I mean, they had some evidence, but obviously, you know, who are they going to tie it to? They don't know shit.
Yeah. Right.
A few months later, in April 1974, Rader broke into the home of Catherine Bright. Catherine's brother, Kevin, was also in the home with her. Surprised by her brother's appearance or his presence in the home, Rader wasn't expecting him to be there. So Rader held him at gunpoint and ordered the brother to restrain his sister with rope. Catherine fought while Rader attempted to strangle her, causing him to become very frustrated because she was fighting back and he wasn't expecting that. So in his frustration, he stabbed her several times and killed her that way. Her brother was also strangled. This guy is a real piece of work. Yeah. So, like I said, a lot of people think he's a monster, and this is why. The brother, Kevin, was also strangled and shot, but he was able to survive his injuries. before his next killing
strangled
spree.
And shot. Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he survived?
I mean,
that's
he
insane.
Did. That's pretty good. I mean, I would hope that.
Phone lines like the movies? Like,
yeah. I didn't
messed up.
I didn't see where he was shot, so I'm not sure like what all his injuries were, but he did survive. Before his next spree of killings, he wrote a letter confessing to the Otero murders. He hid the letter in a book in the public library in October of 1974. I didn't see whether or not that letter was found or if anybody noticed it, but he did leave it hoping that, you know, it would make people stand up and go, oh, this is the guy who killed that family. And but nothing ever came of it. 3 years later, in March 1977, he entered the home of Shirley Relford. She was home with her three children. He pulled a gun out and then proceeded to tie up the children with rope that he had brought. Again, he's coming prepared. He's bringing rope with him. So this is not a spur-of-the-moment thing. And he often picked out his victims and stalked them for a while, too. Not necessarily Jesus. All of them, but he identified them ahead of time and then would watch them and establish, like, their patterns of movement and where they were going and when they would be coming home and things like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's terrifying.
Right? And not even know that somebody's stalking you and watching you and that they're going to do bad things to you if they find you. Ooh, no thanks. So Rader locked the children once he tied them up. He locked them in the bathroom while he proceeded to kill their mother. Thankfully, the children were able to escape before he could get to them. So they also survived. Rader's next victim was Nancy Fox. He began stalking her and attacked her in December 1977. He cut the phone lines to her home before breaking in. He waited for her, and when she came home, he restrained her and strangled her with his belt. Before she died, he confessed to her that he had killed the Otero family. So he's killing this poor woman and bragging about that he's done this
like
before
and
hasn't
family.
Been caught. And I can't, I mean, it's bad enough to be murdered, but to have somebody bragging about
bragging in your face
done,
about it, yeah.
Ugh. The following day, he called the police and tipped them off to the murder. In February 1978, Rader was unhappy with the lack of media attention regarding his murders. You know, he wants the credit, as many of the serial killers that we've talked about before, and I'm sure many more that we will cover, they want the credit for all of the horrible, disgusting things that they've done. So he wasn't getting the attention. And no one was talking about him, so he decided to ramp it up a notch. So he did that by writing a letter and sending it to the local news station. He claimed responsibility for the murders of the Oteros, Bright, Relford, and Fox. He suggested nicknames because they hadn't named him yet, and he was upset about that.
You wanted a
How
nickname?
Dare you?
Jesus.
You're not even talking about me, and I don't have a cool nickname. So in his letter, one of the nicknames that he suggested was BTK for bind, torture, kill, because that's what he would do. He would tie them up, he would torture them, and then he would kill them. So that is where he got the nickname BTK. He essentially gave it to himself. Right. I mean,
this guy's a fucking piece of work.
I didn't really have a nickname. I don't have a nickname as an adult. And I think, you know, every once in a while, I'm like, it'd be kind of cool to have a cool nickname, but I'm not going to give myself a nickname.
You can't
that's
do that.
Trying
you can't
too
give
hard.
Yourself one.
Right. No, that's not allowed. You can't nickname yourself. In the letter, he also stated, quote, how many do I have to kill before I get a name in the paper or some national attention? End quote. He compared himself to Jack the Ripper, Son of Sam, and the Hillside Stranglers, claiming that he and those other killers possessed a supernatural element that drove them to kill. And he called that, quote, Factor X. So.
Jesus. This guy's fucking.
He's weird and delusional, 100%. Yeah. His next attempted victim probably didn't know she was intended to be his victim. Her name was Anna Williams. Raider broke into her home and was waiting for her. But after several hours of waiting, he got tired of waiting for her because she was like at a friend's or something. And he thought, well, she'll be back. And she didn't show up in the time slot that he assumed she would be. And he got mad. Mm-hmm. And so he left. And that was it. She ended up surviving. Nothing happened to her.
Jesus.
She likely didn't even know she had been a target until later when he'd been caught or something. And he was like, oh, by the way, this woman, I was going to kill her. And yeah, I can't even.
Wow.
I mean, yeah, great that she survived just because she took a long time to get home.
But it's freaky knowing that someone was in your house like that.
Right? I mean, there's times where, you know, you're in your own house and you hear something and you're like, am I the only, I'm supposed to be the only one here. Where did that sound come from? That's creepy. But I mean, knowing that the person was in your house with the intent of murdering you and it just happened that you didn't go home.
That's terrifying.
Yes, completely terrifying. So in April 1985, his next victim was Maureen Hedge. Her murder was different from the previous ones in that after killing her, he transported her body. All the other ones, he just left in their homes. This one, though, I don't know why he decided to make it different. He took her body and he transported her to his church where he had prepared an area of the church specifically for this event. He had plastic sheeting up, kind of like Dexter, I'm assuming. Like he had plastic sheeting up. He had prepared the area because he wanted to take pictures of her dead body. And he put her in different bondage positions and took a bunch of pictures of her in different positions. And then he deposited her remains on the side of the road. She was discovered about a week later. Right.
And they probably wouldn't link that to him because it's not his MO.
Right. It's totally different from the previous murders. Yeah. I don't think they had any idea until
he started. What does MO stand for?
Huh?
What does MO stand for?
Modus operandi.
Okay, that's what I thought, but...
Yeah. Yep.
That's, okay.
You got it. You got it. It was about a week before her body was discovered. Then in September 1986, Raider took his next victim. Her name was Vicky Weggerly. He entered her home by pretending to be a phone repairman. He strangled her using her stockings and then photographed her body in several positions. I guess he wanted, you know, he needed some mementos. He was also taking items from his victims, which we'll talk about later, IDs and driver's licenses and things like that.
That's like, why do they all do that? That's just going to get you caught.
Right. They need their trophies so that they can go back and remember it. And that's why he's taking pictures so he can go back and remember the horrible, disgusting things he did because he's a monster. So in 1991, so the last one was 1986. 5 years, he stopped doing bad things. I mean, he was probably still doing gross things, but he wasn't killing anyone that we know of. But in 1991, January of 1991, he had his final victim. Her name was Dolores D. Davis. Her body wasn't located until the following month. She had been strangled with pantyhose. Over a decade later, in 2004, the BTK case, basically they were a long cold. So he stopped killing in 1991. That was his last known victim. 2004, 13 years later, stuff gets kind of reignited. Some of the cases had DNA evidence, but none of them had been matched to a suspect. Because this guy is just completely under the radar. Like, they have no reason to suspect him of anything. So even though they have DNA, they don't have it matched to anyone. There weren't any huge leads at this point. But that changed because he got tired of laying low and started taunting the police and the media again.
Of course. He needs his recognition.
He
his attention.
Does. I mean, 13 years went by.
He didn't get it from his mother, so he had right. to get it from the news.
Exactly. Exactly. So, over the course of several months, Rader started sending letters to the TV stations and leaving mysterious packages around town. In February of 2004, he sent a letter to the Wichita newspaper under the pseudonym Bill Thomas Kilman. He's not very, you know, ingenious with his nicknames, but in it, he claimed responsibility for the murder of Vicki Weggerly, and he included pictures of her and a copy of her driver's license, which had been taken as a trophy. Her death had not been linked to other BTK cases, and the investigators were able to get some DNA from underneath her fingernails. In May 2004, he sent a letter to the TV station with fake IDs and chapter headings for a book proposal. Because, you know, he's that egotistical, he wants people to write books about him. It's not good enough to have his name in the paper. He wants some book recognition. And he's helping them along by coming up with some chapter heading names. I mean, he's just trying to be helpful.
What a nice guy.
Yeah. A month later, he left a package taped to a stop sign that contained detailed descriptions of the Otero murders, a sketch labeled, quote, "The sexual thrill is my bill," end quote, and more chapter titles for his proposed BTK book. A month after that, in July 2004, he left another package by dropping it through the return slot of the public library. He's back at the library again. This time, he claimed responsibility for a death that had actually been ruled a suicide. So I don't know much about this case, but apparently there was a death in another town that had been ruled a suicide, and he was claiming responsibility for it. And they were just like, no, this guy's full of shit. I don't know anything about that other than that information. In October 2004, he left a manila envelope and a UPS box with disturbing images of children pasted to cards and a false autobiography. He also threatened the life of the lead investigator in the package that he left. 2 months later, in December, Rader left a package in a local park. It contained a stolen driver's license of Nancy Fox and a doll that had been bound with rope and a plastic bag over the doll's head.
Jesus.
I know. Dolls,
it's
you
fucking
know,
sick.
I think I've mentioned before, not a fan of dolls. I find dolls creepy. But if I found a doll tied up with rope and a plastic bag over its head, that would probably be the last doll I would ever touch. Yeah, no thanks.
Yeah, that's a little too
it's
horror movie-esque for me.
Yeah, 100%, yeah.
Blair Witch Project type shit.
Right, gross. Yeah, nightmare stuff. He continued leaving messages until the early months of 2005. In one failed attempt to leave a message, Rader had placed a cereal box in the back of a pickup in a parking lot. So he had a package with some evidence inside, and he tossed it in the back of a pickup truck, like a Home Depot or something. The driver of the pickup truck came out, saw it in the back of his truck, and threw it away. Because he's like, I didn't put that there. Why is that there? So he just grabbed the box and threw it away, not knowing there was, you know, BTK evidence inside. Yeah. investigators were able to get video footage of the attempted communication, meaning the cereal box. They found that it was left in the back of that pickup by someone driving a black Jeep Cherokee. So now they have a potential vehicle associated. But, I mean, you know, a black Jeep Cherokee, there's a lot of those.
Hundreds of them. Yeah.
Right. In one of his communications with the police, he asked if sending them information on a floppy disk could be traced. So for our young the police. Audience, yeah. A floppy disk is like a piece of, like, I'm assuming you know what a floppy disk is, Declan, but some people might not.
It's like a big fat USB.
Yeah, it's essentially the old school USB, but it was big. We'll just cut, you know, it was like, they really were like, there were some that were like 5 inches square, and then they got smaller and they were like 2.5 inches square. But essentially it's a USB, it's a storage saving device for computers. So he asks the police, hey, if I send you some information on a floppy disk, can that be traced? And they put an ad in the paper.
Not at all, buddy.
And they're like, no, it's totally fine and safe. You can communicate with us that way. We won't have any way to trace you. And so, Jesus. Of course, he believed them. And thankfully, he believed them, because it is what ended up trapping him in the end. So, because he didn't use a new floppy disk. He used one that had previously been used, but it had files on it that had been deleted. So to the average eye, it looks like, oh, there's deleted files. There was a file on there. I deleted it. It's gone forever. It's not gone forever, people. It's never gone forever. So the file that had been deleted, it was a file that identified his church by name. And it said that the file had last been edited by a person named Dennis. So police then look up the church and discover that Dennis Rader is the president of the church council. They learned that Rader also drove a black Jeep Cherokee.
That's awful suspicious.
Right. But the information, obviously not conclusive enough for them to go arrest him or anything. So they needed a little bit more evidence. They decided to use his daughter's DNA. And so
that's like similar enough, you can link it.
Yes. So they did familial DNA. They got a search warrant to Rader's daughter went to the local college, and she had used the health center at that college for a yearly exam, and they had her pap smear on file. So they were able to use the DNA from her pap smear to trace it, a familial link, close familial link, to Vicky Weggerly's case, the one that they found DNA underneath her fingernails.
That's pretty crazy.
It is wild that they, I don't know how they knew that his daughter had a pap smear and that they could get the DNA from that. I mean, obviously you would know there's DNA, but how did they know that his daughter had just, I don't know. That's a little creepy.
It's a little weird.
It is super weird.
I mean, it was a university hospital, you said?
Yes. Well, it was like the health center at the local college at like Wichita University or something. Yeah.
That's weird. Protected health information. Like, yeah. Well, was HIPAA around back then?
Yeah. Pretty sure. Yeah, for sure it was. 2005. Yeah. Well,
Okay. I didn't realize it was this late after
Yeah, it was this late.
Wow.
So Rader was arrested based on that familial DNA match in February of 2005. He was charged with 10 counts of first-degree murder. He confessed to all accounts and told investigators information about his background. That's where we know about his mommy making him feel ignored. He told them how he liked to steal underwear from his victims, which he would wear himself later, reliving his exploits. Just wearing them wasn't enough, though. He also liked to wear a female mask at the same time. And then he would pretend to be one of his victims in his sexual fantasies. So he's dialing it up a notch. Although he confessed, he declined to speak at his arraignment, so a not guilty plea was entered on each count by the court. However, in June 2005, Rader changed his plea to guilty. He testified in detail regarding each murder, but didn't apologize for any of his actions. He just, like, factual accounts, this is what I did on this day. Never saying, I'm sorry. I think after the fact, during his sentencing, he might have made a comment of regret or something. I don't know. Who really cares at that point? His sentence is fantastic. He was sentenced to 10 consecutive life terms. 10.
Jesus.
Yeah.
So, he's basically thousand years.
I think it was, if I remember right, it was 10 consecutive life terms, no less than 175 years.
Jesus.
Right.
That's funny.
And for his own protection, he's been placed in solitary confinement in prison.
How old was he when he got arrested?
Let's see, 2005. I'm no math expert. He was born in 45. So what is that, 60 years?
Give or take.
Yeah, 2005. Yeah, 60 years old.
Wow.
Yikes.
Yeah. It wouldn't last long in prison being that old.
Right. And, you know, I mean, he's in protective custody, basically solitary confinement, so that nobody offs him. Which is just, it's kind of interesting to me when you think about that he's never, ever, ever getting out. There is no chance. It's not 10 life terms served concurrently. It's consecutive. So they're going to still have his bones sitting around, joking. It would be kind of funny if they did do that, right? But to make sure he doesn't die early, they put him in solitary confinement so nobody can kill him.
Yeah, that's smart.
I mean, it's smart that, you know, somebody else is not going to kill him. And, you know, now they've got his death on their hands. But it just seems bizarre to me. They're like, let's protect this guy so nobody else kills him and let him die of natural causes. So weird.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about the London beer flood.
Oh.
So this story is pretty similar to my the molasses flood in Boston.
I was thinking that. Okay, I'm excited for this. This sounds like fun.
Oh, not for some people, but...
No?
Let's get into it. It was a chilly, cloudy day in the bustling city of London on October 17th, 1814, when disaster struck. In the neighborhood of St. Giles Rookery sat the Mew & Co.'s Horseshoe Brewery, which specialized in brewing beer, specifically porter. The Mew Brewery was one of the largest breweries in London at the time of the accident. The Mew family had been brewing beer for years and at one point even had the largest vat in London capable of holding 20,000 imperial gallons of beer, or barrels of beer, which is around 840,000 gallons.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so a big-ass swimming pool.
Yeah. That vat was made by Sir Richard Mew. And Richard's son Henry acquired the Horseshoe Brewery and wanted to emulate his father's record-breaking vat. And so he decided to craft a wooden vessel that could hold 18,000 imperial barrels, or about 756,000 gallons of beer.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of beer.
The wooden vessel was 22 feet tall and was held together with 81 tons of iron bands.
Whoa.
Yeah.
How tall? What'd you say?
22 feet tall.
20 feet. That's a two-story building.
Yeat. It's a giant vat of beer.
Yeah, it is.
The beer was brewed and then placed in the vessel to age for sometimes up to a year for the best quality. On October 17th, 1814, the storehouse clerk, George Crick, noticed that one of the 700-pound iron bands had fallen off the vessel.
Oh, no. So,
yeah. A band or so would fall off the vessel about once or twice a year, so when George told his supervisor, neither were very concerned. Okay. So this happens all the time, apparently. A band will slip off, and they'll just pop it back on later.
So... I'm wondering what the benefit is of aging beer like that in a giant barrel versus multiple small barrels.
I'll do it all at once, I guess. Save space, maybe. I'm not sure.
Yeah. There's got to be like some practical reason to do it that way. I don't know. That's weird.
George wrote a letter to one of the partners of the brewery explaining the problem to be fixed at a later date. At the time, the vessel held about 149,000 gallons of porter. An hour or so after the missing band was discovered, the vessel unexpectedly burst.
Of course it did.
The pressure of the flooding beer destroyed other smaller vessels inside the brewery, which resulted about 128,000 to 323,000 gallons of beer smashing into the back wall of the brewery. This knocked out the back wall, which was 2 bricks thick.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So it was a tsunami of beer.
Literally.
Yeah.
Hundreds of thousands of gallons of beer flooded the streets of London. Eleanor Cooper was standing in the yard of the brewery washing pots and pans when she was crushed by the large brick wall and killed.
Oh, sad.
The 15-foot wave of porter flooded into the cul-de-sac behind the brewery, completely destroying the first two houses on the street. In the first house, 4-year-old Hannah Bamfield was having a tea party with her mother and a friend when the beer rushed in, sweeping Hannah's mother and friend into the street.
Ooh.
Hannah sadly passed away in the destruction. In the second house, a wake was being held by the family and friends of a 2-year-old boy. Inside the house were 5 people mourning their loss when the house suddenly collapsed due to pressure of the beer wave.
Oh my gosh.
The houses in the cul-de-sac were fairly flat and had little to no drainage, so many of the houses became flooded, forcing residents to climb furniture to avoid drowning.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. In the following days after the floods, hundreds of people got word and rushed over to the brewery to collect beer, which led to a significant increase in drunken people stumbling around London, with one man reportedly dying from alcohol poisoning from the beer he collected.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. On the 19th, On the 19th, the coroner of the area filed an inquest, and it was discovered that 8 people died from the accident.
Wow.
14-year-old Eleanor Cooper, 30-year-old Mary Mulvey, 3-year-old Thomas Murray, 4-year-old Hannah Bamfield, 3-year-old Sarah Bates, 60-year-old Anne Salville, 27-year-old Elizabeth Smith, and 65-year-old Catherine Butler. It was decided that the flood was an act of God, which meant the brewery did not have to pay any settlements to the families of the deceased. The company was dissolved in the early 1960s. Well, do you have a chaser?
I do have a chaser. My chaser is a watch recommendation on Apple Plus TV, and it's the show or the series Bad Monkey with Vince Vaughn. And Vince Vaughn plays a police officer who gets fired from being a police officer, and then he becomes a restaurant food inspector, but it's all about a mysterious arm that turns up, and the writing in it is really good. There's a lot of funny parts. It's not like gory and dark and gross, but it's really funny, and we have laughed a lot at this show. It's like a murder mystery kind of thing, but it's really funny, so I highly recommend it.
I saw the first episode of that. I just haven't finished the series. It was really good, though.
We haven't finished the series either. It's so good.
I like anything with Vince Vaughn, though. So
I know. He's great. He's great. Yeah. And he gets funnier as the show goes on. So I think you'll really like it, because his humor is, like, so, like, dry and dark but funny. It's a really good show.
I'm about to finish that.
Yeah. What is your chaser?
My chaser is an Instagram account called The Eats of History. Well, I guess it's not the just Eats of History, whole one word. And it's this guy who makes, like, a bunch of food from history, like Roman food. He'll make, like, this is what Spartans would eat before they went out to battle, and he does, like, this is Jimmy Carter's favorite food, or different presidents and stuff like that. It's pretty interesting.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, he, like, shows, like, the one I, like, saw first on his page was he made, like, the number one snack they would eat at the Colosseum.
Really? And it was, like, what was it?
Dates stuffed with nuts covered in, like, honey.
That sounds good, actually. Have you had
pretty tasty.
Have you had the dates that I make, where it's dates with it's a date that's been seeded, so no seed inside, no pit inside, stuffed with an almond, and then wrapped in bacon and baked.
Mmm, that sounds good.
It's so good. It's delicious. It is an addictive little appetizer, which we're going to a party soon, so maybe I'll make those for that party, because that sounds really good and super easy. I mean, it's not complicated. You take a date, you shove some, I use the smoked almonds, so it's got a little smokiness to it, but it's a little bit of salt. and then you wrap it in bacon and bake it in the oven until the bacon's cooked. Man, I could eat a whole friggin'. I could eat a lot of those and make myself sick because, I mean, bacon, I'm sorry. Bacon is like, I feel bad for people who don't eat bacon because it's the greatest thing in the entire world. I could never be a vegetarian because of bacon.
Yeah. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Yes,
thanks for joining
you.
Us once again.
Absolutely. For anyone interested in leaving us an Apple review, we would love to have an Apple review with, like, not just a 5-star, although we love the 5 stars. Keep giving us those. But if you want to leave us a worded review that says how fantastic we are, we will read it out on a future episode. And then we will give you all the credit for being an awesome awesome listener.
Yes, go check us out. Give us all 5-star reviews. 100%. Give us a follow on all your streaming platforms.
Yes. And share us with everyone you know. Tell everyone. Be that obnoxious Amway salesperson, but you're selling Brutal Bazaar and Boozy instead.
Yes.
All right. We'll talk to you later. Love you, bud.
Love you too. Bye.
Bye. Hey, friends. Thank you for supporting our podcast. Please share our show with your brutal and bizarre friends. Give us a boozy follow on your favorite podcast platform. If you're feeling extra generous, we'd appreciate a 5-star rating or review as well. But maybe do that sober so all the letters are in the right place.
You can find all our contact information in the show notes. We love hearing from you, and if you're interested in helping us stock the bar for our future boozy episodes, you can find our Patreon link in the show notes as well.